And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for the evening, Kip C. from Vista.
My name's Kip Collins, and I'm an alcoholic. Congratulations on the 6 month and the 2 years. That's great. So, you know, we came in here, we only had a path. You know, as a result of coming in here, if we stick around, we get a future, you know. I got sober here, and my sobriety date, May 12th, 1984. My home group is the Vista Men's Robbers Roost. It's a bunch of convicts that meet on Thursday night. In fact, the meeting just now broke up, and it's not in any schedule. The only way you can get there is to be invited. It's a group of men trying to learn how to live by spiritual principles one day at a time and not drink any alcohol or put anything in our body that affects us from the neck up, and to walk through life and accept life on life's terms with, no matter what happens. I was raised in Vista, up the road a bit. It was a little town when I was a kid, and my father's Irish and Sioux. My mother's Irish and Cherokee. And when my daddy drank, my mama liked to fight, you know. And that's the way it was, you know. I lived in an all-alcoholic neighborhood. You know, there wasn't anything different. We were the only Anglos in this whole neighborhood. It was all first-generation Hispanic. Nobody spoke English. I thought my name was Pinche Huero most of my life, you know. And, you know, the old man would be coming up the road. It'd be late, you know. And they knew what was going to happen, you know. Pretty soon you'd see people turning off their lights and getting their lawn chairs and coming outside, you know, and getting comfortable because the show was about to start. And that's the way it was. That was normal, you know. And it wasn't much different from my house than it was anyone else's on that street. This shit was coming down. I was never going to be an alcoholic. I swore to God I'm never going to be an alcoholic. I'm never going to be like my dad. I do not blame my alcoholism on my father. You know, if anything in the world, my father taught me what alcohol will do to a man. He taught me what it'll do to a family, what it'll do to children, what it'll do to a career. He was a prime example. I blame my alcoholism on the San Diego Unified School District. When I was 12 years old, they had this idea that there was time to start educating the young people about the dangers of drugs. And they went and took us in this auditorium, and they showed us these movies, and they had these people come up here and start talking to us, explain what this stuff did. Man, when they were done, my mouth was watering, and I asked my buddy Balto, I said, "Balto, can you get some of this shit?" He says, "Yeah." And we met the next day after school. We went down this little canyon. Before we left, he says, "We got to get a bottle of wine." I said, "What for?" He says, "I don't know. My dad drinks cheap wine with this shit, you know." And I said, "Okay." So we went down to this little store. We each ripped off a short dog of sweet red port. Went down this canyon, smoked this dope, drank this wine, and click, it happened. Most magic moment of my life. You know, there was a speaker when I first got sober. One of the first speakers I ever heard, and I identified with that man. Named Serenity Sam from Venice, California. And he talked about when he was a kid. He says, "I fell out of my mother's womb. I hit a cold concrete floor and was crawling across hostile territory towards my grave. And then I discovered alcohol." And I knew exactly what he was talking about, you know, because up to that point, I'd been scared to death of this world, you know. I knew how to play the game and act tough and put on that facade and put on that armor, you know. But I was scared to death. I didn't fit in anywhere, you know. All my cousins are real dark skin. They have dark hair, dark eyes. All the neighborhood I lived in was all Hispanic, man. You know, I didn't fit in my neighborhood. I didn't fit in my family. And I learned how to live there, and I didn't fit in with the Anglo kids. I didn't fit in anywhere, me and my brother. But when I put that alcohol on my body, I fit in. My skin fit for the first time in my life, and everything was okay. You know, I knew all about these first three steps a long time before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that my life was unmanageable, and I was scared to death of this world. You know, I smoked this dope and drank this wine, and I came to believe that there was a power. to restore me to sanity, and I immediately, with no reservation, turned my will and life over it, and I never looked back. When I was about 14 years old, I got kicked out of school for hitting a teacher, and right after that, my mom found my dope, and she kicked me out of the house. I was 14 years old, and I'd never been anywhere. It was 1964. And a friend of mine over in Carlsbad, we're reading in the paper, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. And he says, check this out. He says, he's showing me something in the paper. He says, look, these people are going up to this place, and all they do is get high and listen to music and make love. I like music, you know. And I went up to this place called Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. And I got a different kind of an education up there, you know. When other young men were going to school, you know, and getting an education or going learning a trade or going into the service, you know, I spent the next 4 years up there and in Mexico. And I learned from a very early age that if I had the bag, I could have anything or anybody I wanted. And it ain't nothing I'm proud of. And I'd like to make a clarification right off the bat that I understand and respect the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous with all my heart. I respect the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, but part of my story has drugs in it, and if it bothers anybody, I'll give you an opportunity to grow tonight. I was never going to be a drunk, man. We smoked dope, we ate that LSD, you know, I found out, you know, that I spoke a little bit of Spanish, you know, and I knew some people, and I touched a couple things together, and I started smuggling dope when I was about 15 and a half. And I got busted in Mexico when I was 16 with 200 kilos. And I went to La Mesa Federal Prison at 16 years old. And I'm going to tell you this from my heart to yours. I don't have to tell you what happened. You know, not a nice thing happens to young little white boys in big prisons like that. They ain't real friendly, but they're sure glad to see you, you know. You know, if anything in this world, that should have told me that my manner of living was going to be very uncomfortable. If anything in the world, that should have changed my mind about the way I wanted to live. But you see, I had an angle, you know, I had some money, and I was hooked up with some people, and they got me out of there after about 6 months. And I continued to go do what I do. On my 18th birthday, I woke up with a gun in my mouth from a DEA agent. I was charged with 27 felonies. I spent the next year up here at San Diego, up in 5E, maximum security, facing 25 years. And after 11 months and 28 days, they came in, and the two guys that I was arrested with, they pled guilty, and they dropped charges against me and another guy and this guy's girlfriend, and they just rolled us up, you know. And if anything in the world, that should have taught me, you know, what I'm doing, man, this ain't working, you know. But I got out of there, and I continued to do what I do, and I picked up another beef, their sales of heroin. And I went to jail again. 2 years. I got out of there and I started running around with this young gal. While I was in prison that time, I'd been hooked up with this young gal, and she was pregnant when I went in. She came from a real good family. And that family moved her out of the way. They didn't want her anywhere near me, and when I got out, I started looking for her. Could somebody please bring me a glass of water? I'm really dry here. Oh, there it is. Thanks. You know, when I got out, I looked everywhere. I tried to track this woman down. I wanted to find my kid. All I ever wanted to be was a father, man. I dreamed about that kid, you know, and when I was a kid, I used to think all I ever want to have is a family, you know. I want kids, and I want a lady to stand by me, and I want all this stuff, and I want the house and the respect in my community. I didn't want the neighbors looking at me the way my neighbors looked at my dad, you know, and I wanted all that stuff. I didn't know how to get it, you know. I couldn't find her, and there was this hole in my gut for a long, long, long time. This little girl, she's 15 years old. I hooked up with her, and she had some money. Her family was a doctor. Father was a doctor. And And she bailed me out of jail 3 times in a 2-week period. And I don't know too much about love, but I know a lot about jail, you know, and I just made a commitment that I was never going to let that little girl out of my sight, you know, and we decided to get married. And we got married, and then she told me that she was pregnant, and about 9 months later, we were up in Oregon, and I was on parole. We went to the hospital, and she gave me this little boy. She put this little boy in my arms, David. And I'll never forget that moment as long as I live. It was the most glorious moment of my life. And they put that little boy in my arms, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and something magic happened inside my heart. I'd never known anything about love. I knew about lust, I know about all that other stuff, but absolutely, totally unconditional love, I'd never experienced it before. And I looked at that baby and something happened inside of me. And I fell head over heels in love with this kid. And I started making plans and I started making this kid promises that he was never going to live the kind of life I live. And I was going to give him all the stuff and we were going to do all those things that fathers do with their sons. And I made all these plans and had all these dreams. You know, 2 years later, we were back down here, and my wife put a little girl in my arms, Jana Marie. And it was the exact same thing happened, you know. They put that baby in my arms, and I fell head over heels in love. Absolutely, totally head over heels in love. You know, I started making plans immediately, you know, for her. Someday someone's going to want to marry her, so I'm planning it. She's still wet, you know. But I'm the kind of an alcoholic. I can be sitting in a meeting, a pretty gal walk by, you know, and before the meeting's over, we've had a 10-year relationship, a couple of kids, been divorced, and I walk out of the room hating her, you know. Things happen quick in here, you know. And I made promises to this little girl. You know, for the next 5 years from that day, I was probably the most devoted and the best father any man's ever been. I had the money. I had the resources. I had a real nice place. I had it fixed up for kids. It was just a big, giant playground. And I had every toy and everything that you could possibly have for kids. And I worked. You know, I would do a scan 2 or 3 times a year. And we'd take 9 tons of dope to Massachusetts or someplace else and move it, you know, and I'd live off that for the next year or whatever, you know. But I wanted to stay with my family, and that's what I did. Everything was about me staying with my kids. And for the next 5 years, that's what I did. And on September 6th, 1976, I was playing with my son. We were playing in the garage. It was real, real hot that day. And I was smoking this dope. I got real stoned and I got thirsty, you know, and I didn't tell anybody I was leaving. My son was born deaf. I didn't mention that to you. And, you know, you had to watch him all the time. You couldn't let him out of your sight. And I just got on my bike, you know. I didn't even think about telling anybody I was leaving. I just got on my bike and went up to the store to go get a six-pack. And on the way back, coming back, the cops were at my house and the paramedics and all the neighbors, and I walked down there and my son had chased me out of the driveway and he'd been run over by a truck. And I waded through that crowd and I got to my son and his head was split open and I could see his brains and most of the bones were protruding out of his body and he was broken up into 100 pieces. Something inside of me died that day. My son didn't die. My son lived. My son lived, but stayed in a coma for the next 9 months. And over the next 18 years, we went through 27 major brain surgeries, and he was in the hospital. Out of that 18 years, 15 of them. And my son had massive brain damage. he couldn't talk, and he couldn't write, and he couldn't comprehend a lot of things, and he never emotionally grew past the age of about 4 years old. When my son was in the hospital with this coma, my brother, who had been my everything I've told you about tonight, my brother was my right hand, Bill. We were 11 months apart, and we backed each other's play, right or wrong, no matter what went on, man. He was right beside me, and he was the best friend I've ever had. There's nobody in the world I trusted more than him. And my brother came down with an organic mental condition called schizophrenia. And my family had him committed to a hospital, and they got him stabilized on his medicine, and he called me from this hospital, and he said, "Kip," he says, "get me out of this hospital, man." You know, and it wouldn't have made much difference if he'd been in a federal pen. I would have got him out if he would have asked me. You know, I had the money, the resources. I got a lawyer. I became his conservator. You know, I got charge of his life, and I brought him home with me, and I bought him a mobile home and set it up on a piece of property. And I said, "Don't worry about those people, man. It's always been me and you, and it always will be." And me and my brother started doing what we always did. My brother started deteriorating right away as soon as he left the hospital. I had to go back east, man. I had to go to Oklahoma on this scam, and my brother was begging me not to go. He says, "Kip, don't go. Something's wrong. You know, I'm coming apart." And I'm going, "Man, I gotta go. I gotta go." I said, "Look, man, here's some money." I handed him a handful of money. I always figured money would fix anything. And I said, "I'll be back in 3 days, and me and you'll square this up. Don't worry about it, man. Just hang tight." And I got back on the scam, and it went sideways, and I was gone for almost 2.5 weeks. And when I got back, I went to go find my brother, and no one had seen him. I went back over to his trailer, and I opened that door, and his head rolled out, that he had taken a gun on the third day, and he'd blown his head completely off. And what was laying there in the doorway was just a big pile of maggots in my brother's head. And another big giant piece of me died. You know, and I don't tell you this because I want your pity, your sympathy. I sure as hell don't need it. You know, the only point in me telling you this is that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about a certain type of people who got here with grave emotional and mental disorders. And I'm one of those people. Something inside of me broke that day that was never to be repaired until I totally surrendered to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. From that point on, there wasn't enough. You know, alcohol and dope and everything had been a lot of fun. It had never been a real problem, except when I got caught selling it, you know. I kept my shit together. What I did was pretty big time, and, you know, and you just don't screw up doing what I was doing. People will kill you, and you know, and I had a lot of respect for that stuff. But from that point on, the alcohol took over my life. The narcotics took over my life. And I tell you this from my heart to yours, that I thank God that alcohol and drugs did for me what it did for me. You know, if it wouldn't have worked, I wouldn't be here. I would have joined my brother. But alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. It blocked all that pain. It blocked those pictures. It blocked all that feeling of guilt, of remorse, of all that stuff. It blocked all those feelings, and it worked real, real, real good. You know, they talk a lot about bottoms in AA, and I guess you all know about bottoms. It's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that that's kind of a myth. I've known some people that hit bottom. My ex-mother-in-law, she hit bottom. She spent the last 10 years of her life in a hospital for women with wet brain, Kerckhoff syndrome. And she didn't know who she was for the last 10 years of her life, and she never drank nothing but beer, you know. But alcohol completely destroyed her. And she hit bottom because, see, she never got any worse after a certain point. It never got no worse. I had a young man that I was sponsoring here last year. He had 90 days sober and had a nice family and had a whole future and everything. He got in an argument with his wife. And he went down and he got a quart of vodka and locked himself in his van and he drank it straight down and he died. And he hit bottom. So he ain't never going to get no worse. You know, that was it. But it's been my experience that as long as I can think and feel and have anything in here going on at all, man, every time I think there's a bottom, man, I'll guarantee you there's a basement. You know, the stuff and the people, that goes pretty quick. you know. And that ain't nothing, you know. That ain't nothing. Losing a family, you think it's a big deal when it's happening, you know, but it ain't no big deal. You lose all your stuff, it just kind of makes your life a little bit simpler, you know. But what alcohol did to me, and I don't know about you, but I can only tell you about me, it started taking a little piece of me. My wife told me that she left. She, you know, I was so nuts and so crazy. She left, and she left me with my little girl. And you know, the next thing I know, this guy brought over this stuff. I'd never drank it before. Maybe you guys have heard of it. It's called Mad Dog 2020. They have that in San Diego. I drank some of this stuff, and in fact, I drank a whole bunch of it. And I come to, and my little girl snuggled up against me. She's 7 years old, and there's this lady. I'm on a wide-body jet, and the plane's empty. And this hostess lady, she's going, "Sir, you have to get off the plane." And I looked around, and I said, "Where am I?" And she said, "You're in Fort Lauderdale." I told her that I didn't like Fort Lauderdale, you know, and I have no idea why I'm here. To this day, I have no idea why I was there. But I woke up in Fort Lauderdale with my little girl, and I did what any good drunk would do, you know. I got off the airplane, I scratched my head, I asked my daughter real subtly if she knew what was going on. You know, I didn't want to play stupid, I just tried to, you know, try to feed me some information, and so I caught a cab. I had a pocket full of money. I had no idea where all that came from. I found out later that I sold probably $150,000 worth of personal items for about $2,000. You know, the biggest, quickest garage sale Vista's ever known. And I don't know why, but a lot of things I don't know why I did. Anybody relate to that? Just kind of woke up. Must have seemed like a good idea at the time, you know. And I said, "Look, take me to a hotel, but stop at a liquor store. And I need to get a drink so I can figure out what's happened here." And the next thing I know, I woke up in this deal, and they had taken my clothes away, and I'm strapped down on a gurney with this sheet over me. And I'm in this place called the Bart in Fort Lauderdale. It's like this. It's a county detox, except they have bars. And I didn't know where my daughter was. Had no idea where my daughter was. Had no idea what happened. I found out later that I'd met this couple, and I started drinking, and I got nuts and went crazy. And they locked me up, and these people took my daughter. You know, thank God. The next 2 years, we lived in 5 different states, and probably 30 different counties. And every place we lived, I told my daughter, I made her a solemn promise that it's going to be different. I'm going to get a home. I'm going to get a job. You're going to go to school. We're going to have our own house. We're going to go to church on Sunday, and we're going to be a family. I made her these promises, and I wanted to do it so bad. But you see, I've never worked. I had never, at that point, had an ID in my name. I've never had a Social Security card, and I'm a player, you know. And I can find some action. I don't care where you put me. I can look around, and I can see someone that's got something going on pretty quick, you know. And I'll get in the game, and I'll get something going. And that's what would happen. I'd get some money in my pocket. The next thing I knew, I'd be drinking. The next thing, someone would be hurt, and I'd be running, you know. And that's the way it was going on. The last place was in Oklahoma City. I come to from this bar, and I got blood all over me, and it wasn't mine. And my little girl, she looked up at me, and she was 9 years old by this time. We were in this little shack, and she knew. She knew. She just jumped up. She grabbed her doll and started running out the back door with me right behind her. And we got to that Greyhound bus station, and we got on the bus, and I passed out as soon as we got on the bus. And I come to. We're in Gallup, New Mexico, and my little girl was rocking and crying. And I said, "What's the matter, baby?" And she said, "Daddy, I'm so hungry. You ain't fed me." And I said, "As soon as we stop, I'm going to get you something to eat, honey. And we're going back to California. Everything's going to be okay." And that bus stopped, and I got off that bus to get my little girl something to eat. And I walked in this little liquor store, and I was sicker than a dog, man. I walked in there, and the first thing I did, I grabbed me a quart of port wine. And I went over to this little place, and I grabbed her a little sandwich, and I went up to go pay for it. And I found out I only had enough money for one or the other. And I had to put her sandwich back, you know. I've done a lot of things in this world. I've done a lot of things that I don't share from the podium. But I've never done anything in my life that haunted me more than that moment when I had to get back and look at my little girl and tell her that I just spent her food money when she was starving on wine. You see, alcohol owned me. I got back to California, and I went over to try to touch my mom up, you know, and she took one look at me. My mom could, she'd kick everybody out of Al-Anon. And she has no mercy with anyone, you know. Just get the hell out of here, you know. She grabbed my daughter and she told me to hit the bricks, you know. I grabbed my daughter and said, "Where will we go?" She grabbed my daughter and said, "We ain't going nowhere. You are." And I left. And I love my mom. I got the greatest mom in the world, man. She takes no prisoners. Unless you're a little kid, you know. And she released me with love. And the next 3 years, I don't really know what happened. I was a wino. I lived in the bushes. I lived on the side of the road. I panhandled for wine in front of the 7-Eleven in Carlsbad. And I went to jail on a regular basis. I went to detox on a regular basis. I came down here on a regular basis. And I was my sponsor, Charlie Tucker, I was a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot. But you know, alcohol worked, and it worked real good. It took all the feelings, all the stuff away, and I didn't care. I was walking by in front of this 7-Eleven one morning, and I saw this guy. I recognized him. He was a guy I grew up with, and there he was. He was in a three-piece suit, and he had this square little wife and a square little kids and a square little four-door sedan. And he got out of the car, and I just looked at him, and I wondering how he could live that way, you know. Being alcoholics, we're the only people in the world be laying face down in the gutter looking down on everybody else, you know. But he looked at me and he smiled and he gave me $2. I don't know, it's first thing in the morning. I don't know if there's any real winos here today, but man, when you get $2 first thing in the morning, poo! It's on, baby. No shuffling around in that parking lot, man. I can get me a quart and get well right now, you know. And it was like I'd died and gone to heaven, man. I'm going to be well till probably 2 o'clock in the afternoon, man. I ain't got to hustle. I ain't got to do nothing. Get my wine, get down to my little hole in the bamboo and sit in the mirror. And I was looking. I could see this family and that guy, and they're all looking at me. I'm thinking they're judging me, you know, and I'm cussing them. I get over to my little bamboo patch and I'm still cussing him. But you know, that guy ended up to be a real good friend of mine. And I don't believe religion has anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't bring it in, but I'll tell you, that was a good Christian family. And they weren't judging me. Right after I shuffled off, they got our whole family got out of their car and got on their knees and they prayed for that poor drunk. About the time they were praying for that poor drunk, I'm opening up this bottle, getting ready to take a hit off of it, man, because that's the only thing I wanted in this whole world, and I had the damnedest thought I've ever had in my life. Maybe I ought to go to A&A. Now, that's a weird thing to be thinking about when you're sick. First thing in the morning and a quart in your hand. Probably just a coincidence, you know, but I don't know how, but I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And I walked in this room. See, I'd been to A&A before down here. You know, they have a 3-day and all that. They bring in these A&A people. I was in jail. The H&I people brought in those places. And different institutions I've been in, those people brought in those meetings, you know. But, you know, they were all squares. I didn't want nothing to do with these people. They didn't live in the world that I lived with. And they didn't understand what was going on, man. They didn't even know what time of day it was, you know. But I decided, they told me that if I ever had a problem with alcohol, I ought to give them a shot. You know, we welcome you with open arms. So I got up to this meeting and I walked in. And nobody welcomed me with open arms. You know, I weighed about 125 pounds. My hair was down past my waist and my beard was past my belt. A lot of things lived on me, and I've been living in these clothes for almost 3 years. And a lot of things lived on me besides me. And I walked in that room and I sat down. These were all real nice people from the coast, man. There was Mercedes and Porsches and they were clean cut, looking fine, man. You know, and I'm looking in this room. They're looking at me and I'm looking around and I'm going, I wonder if they have a room for the more severe cases, you know. And I'm uncomfortable, man. I don't fit in here. I'm going, jeez, these people aren't drunks, you know. And they're, you know, they're talking about God. And then they're passing that basket. I know they're going to start singing any minute, you know. I just know it. Any minute they're going to start singing. I'm getting ready to get my hat, man. You know, I don't fit in here. These people don't know what's going on. I knew it was a mistake with the first thought I had of it, you know. I'm getting ready to get out of my seat, but from the moment I got to that meeting, there was this one old gal. She kept looking at me and smiling, trying to catch my eye. She'd smile at me, you know. And, you know, as sick as I was, I knew I didn't have anything this woman wanted, you know. But I got ready to leave, and she jumped to her feet just like that. And she looked right at me, and she introduced herself as an alcoholic woman. And she said, you know, I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in Long Beach, California, 27 years ago. She says, I walked in the back door, and I looked around, and I looked at all you ladies. And you were all so well-dressed and so clean-cut. And I looked at you men, and I knew all about men. She goes, and I turned around to leave because I knew once you saw who I was, you'd know what I was, and you'd turn your back on me the way you always had. She goes, I've been a prostitute on the streets of Los Angeles since I was 14 years old, and I've done everything a woman ever had to do to survive out there. She goes, when I started to leave and someone grabbed me and they brought me in and they got me a cup of coffee and they told me to stick around, that they needed her. She proceeded to talk about the next 27 years of her recovery and the remarkable things that had happened and about her family and about her career. And she finally, she walked right over in front of all those people that didn't want nothing to do with me, and she put her arms around me, and she hugged me real tight, and she kissed me right on the mouth. Bravest woman I've ever known in my life. And she whispered in my ear, and this is what she said. She said, please, please keep coming back here. We need you desperately. I have never cried in my life, no matter what's ever happened to me. But I started crying. Something happened inside here where I live. And I started crying because this woman had reached out with love to an animal, to a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot when no one else, even the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, didn't want anything to do with him. And I started coming to this A&A, you know. I wanted what that woman had more than anything in this world. I started coming, but right off the bat, you all lied to me right from the beginning. You told me if I stopped drinking alcohol, my life would get better. Now, I don't know what alcohol does for you, but alcohol is not my problem. Narcotics are not my problem. They've caused some problems in my life, but they are not my problem. They are my solution for living in this world. You know? You know what happens when you take alcohol away from alcoholic? You know what's left? Ick. That's it. That was all that was left. I stopped drinking and it was, ugh. Now I know why I drank, you know. Life sucks sober, you know. All those visions, all that pain, all that guilt, all that shit just starts washing over me. You know, you also told me to get a sponsor, and I've been on parole for half my life. I'm not going to volunteer for it, you know. Especially to one of these lops, you know. And, saw this thing about restore me to sanity. I tried to kill a guy when I was about 11 years old, and I've been under psychiatric help ever since. And so I'm thinking, you know, if I've never been sane, what are they ever going to restore me to, you know? So I drove by that one. Then I got to this God stuff, turned my will and life over to God. Hey, baby, God never did nothing for me. He never did nothing for me, man. He likes those people in the suburbs. He don't like people like me. I just piss him off. You know, I cried out to that God when I was a young man in prison. God wasn't there, believe me. You know, I tried to cry out to God a number of things. When the guys cut my partner's throat and were coming after me, I cried out to God. Didn't do my buddy a good bit of good. I cried out to that God when my brother killed himself. I cried out to this God when my son was laying there with his brains all over the street. God was never there. He never did nothing for me. I had nothing coming, and he had nothing coming for me. And I just drove by that shit, you know. I got to that next thing. It says that I got to write down everything I ever did and admit it to another human being. You bet. Man, I learned when I was a kid, you don't cop to nothing, even if they got pictures, you know. Deny it, you know. Demand a jury trial. Make them prove every bit of it, you know. I ain't going to give you any information about me, especially something negative, man. You'll use it against me. I can show weakness to another man or a woman. I ain't telling a woman nothing, you know. Excuse me, ladies. I've changed and grown a great deal in the last 14 years. You know, and I saw this thing, except, you know, I got to make a list of everybody I took down and I got to pay them back. Yeah, that's what I said. I'll tell you a little story. I'll move ahead just a little bit. I've never told this from the podium, but I feel real comfortable telling you. My sponsor was a guy named Charlie Tuck, and I was about 6 months sober. And Charlie Tuck took me on my first 12-step call. At 6 months sober, I was still packing a gun. And I had it in my boot, and he took me on this 12-step call, and I walked in this house, and there's this guy sitting there. And I went, oh, shit. I robbed this guy, you know. I took him down for 10 grand and a kilo of cocaine, you know, about 2.5 years before. And I'm going, I'm sitting there. He's looking at me. He's going, God, you look familiar. You know? I got my hand next to my boot, right next to my gun. I said, if he even moves funny, I'm going to shoot him, you know. And then I'm going, if I shoot him, I'm going to have to shoot Charlie. I don't have to leave any witnesses, you know. And it was a hell of a predicament to be in at 6 months over, you know. But anyway, getting back. Pay someone back? You bet. I ain't going to give it up, man. If you're stupid enough, if you're lame enough to let me get hold of your shit, that's on you, man, you know. And this other stuff, you know, I just didn't want anything. I just wanted to come to these meetings, speaker meetings. I wanted to learn the lingo. I wanted to squeeze you girls. I wanted to glad hand you guys, you know, and that's what I did. I come here, and I learned all the easy does it one day at a time, you know, blah, blah. Hey, baby, you know, let's go have some coffee and all that, and all this shit. You know, and I did that for 6 years, and for 6 years I collected the largest number of tokens I could open up my old central office, you know. I couldn't stay sober, you know. And if anyone here is thinking they're here and they're going to stay sober on other people's sobriety, you got a painful road to walk, baby, let me tell you. There's only one softer, easier way to get sober is through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're not actively taking these steps and applying these steps in your life, you are not in recovery. I don't care what you think. You know, you can have the greatest sponsor in the world. You can have all the commitments and everything in the world going on here. But if you're not living by the principles of the 12 step, you are not in recovery. And your disease is progressing. Dr. Selfworth told us a long time ago, right at the beginning of that book, that we must experience a complete psychic change. And if we do not experience that psychic change, we're doomed to do this over and over. He says, but if we follow a few simple rules, we don't have to do that. Those few simple rules, actually there's 12 of them, you know. There's 12 of those rules. And they're not rules, they're highly suggestions, you know. It's like, they're real good suggestions. I went on and on, man, and I okey-doked this program for a long time. And I came in, and part of my life got better. You know, if you just hang around sober people, nothing else, part of your life will get better. It didn't get better in here. Didn't get better in here, but the outside got a little bit better, you know. And I come to 1983, Christmas morning. I've come to many times this way, in that rubber room, butt naked, completely shackled down, you know, covered in blood. My head, my face is stuck to that mat with my own blood. And it's Christmas morning at about 5:30, and you open your eyes and you look up in those little portholes, and the sheriffs are looking down at you laughing, you know. And you just know Santa Claus ain't coming, you know. You just know it ain't coming.
He ain't got nothing coming, man. And, I found out I got belligerent with the cop, and he beat the hell out of me. I'm sure I deserved it. And they let me go. It was Christmas, and I just wandered off. You know, I'd been around here. I said, I ain't coming back to this A&A. This place sucks. It ain't for people like me. I'm that person in Chapter 5. I can't get sober, you know. Every time I stop drinking, all those feelings come up again, all that stuff, you know, and I go absolutely stark raving sober, you know. That's a horrible place to be. And so I went home and I started drinking. I had a little tiny apartment by now, you know, and I had a little nest egg of a little bit of cash, and I went down and got all the liquor I could carry. And I went back up to this place and I sat there and I started drinking. And I drank and I drank. And on January 6, 1984, the worst day of my life, the worst thing that's ever happened to me in my life happened. The alcohol stopped working. That was the absolute most traumatic thing that I've ever experienced in my life, when all of a sudden I realized I couldn't get drunk, and it didn't take away the feelings. It amplified all everything that was going on. And I couldn't get sober, and I couldn't drink, and it wouldn't knock me out. And I just drank and drank and drank and drank, and it wouldn't work. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and A Vision for You, it talks about that. It says there'll come a time where you will not be able to imagine life with alcohol or without it. You'll know loneliness such as few people can even imagine. You'll come to the jumping off spot and you wish for the end. I picked up my gun and I put it to my heart and I pulled the trigger and I blew my left lung and two ribs out. And it knocked me all the way across the room. And the only thought I had was, thank God, this nightmare is over with. Thank God I'm not going to humiliate myself in front of anybody anymore. Just let me out of here. You know, and then I come to in this damn hospital. You guys thought I died, I bet, didn't you? I come to in this hospital, I got whole tubes coming out of every hole in my body and a few new ones, you know, and you know, and I get back a little bit. There was this guy, I've talked about him before already. His name was Charlie Tuck. And Charlie Tuck, I hated that son of a bitch, you know. Because he got dead in my face one time when I was at an AA meeting. He came up and he got down right down in my face. And he says, "You think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid?" I looked him right in the eye. I gave him my best jailhouse look. And I said, "Yeah, I'm tough enough, old man. Don't you ever doubt that." He looked at me and he smiled. He says, "You ain't tough." He says, "You're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room." He said, "That might make you dangerous, but it don't make you tough." And he walked away laughing at me, you know. And well, I hated that son of a bitch, you know. And every time I'd go to a meeting, I'd get in there, I'd look, "Oh, shit, that guy's here. I'm not going in there," you know. So, you know, I'll tell you, the last person in the world I wanted to see was Charlie Tuck. And I'm coming out of this coma, you know, and all I could hear is Charlie had a real unique, deep, gravelly voice. I could hear that. I thought I'd died and gone to hell, you know. Oh, God, and he's waiting for me, you know. And I open my eyes, and there's Charlie standing at the foot of my bed with that big, ugly blue book and these two newcomers looking at me with their eyes real big. And I went, "Oh, man, he's going to start preaching that A&A shit, you know." And I went, "Oh, man." I closed my eyes, man. I'm going to give it up, you know. He didn't say a word to me. He says to these youngsters with him, he says, "You see this fella here?" And they go, "Yeah." And they go, "This is what happens to an alcoholic who doesn't take the steps. Come on, let's go." Well, I didn't think it was funny. I was humiliated, you know. I didn't want his help, but I did want him to offer, you know. Wanted him to feel sorry for me, maybe, or something. Say something nice, you know. Say nothing to me. Incidentally, those two gentlemen are still sober, you know. And I was doing active 12-step work long before I got sober. And I got out of that hospital. I hooked up with a good friend of mine who who just made the papers. He just shot a cop up in Oceanside. And he had half the money of the planet. And you know, he says, come on, Kip, you've had a rough time. And he took me up to this big mansion he had, and he had the best-looking women living there, and he had the best dope, and he had this big fancy bar, and he's trying to teach me how to make something called a martini. I don't know. I just wanted something in a screw cap myself, you know. sure took a long time to make this, you know. Just drink the shit, you know. And, you know, alcohol didn't work. It didn't work. I kept wanting it to work. The dope didn't work. The women didn't work. Nothing worked. I was empty and hollow in a vast desert of emptiness inside my very soul. It was hollow and empty and lonely. And if loneliness would have been a tangible thing, it would have absolutely eaten me alive. May 12th, I come to the same way I always come to. When my eyes open, I need to get something in my body now. You know, before the screaming starts, you know. I have to get something in there before the screaming starts. And I come to, it's another one of those weird things I come to, and the first thing in my mind was what they read at the end of all these meetings, you know. The ABCs, chapter 5, basically the first three steps. It says I'm powerless over alcohol, you know, and my life's unmanageable, you know. And I knew that I was powerless over, I knew I was an alcoholic. I had no problem in denial about me being an alcoholic. I knew the state of California told me I was an alcoholic. There was no illusion about it. But in the 12 by 12, it states this. It says, it doesn't matter what you admit to me or to anyone else. The first step has to do with your innermost self in deep down in there where you live. You have to understand exactly what that means. And you know, and I was thinking about it, and all of a sudden I had that vision, you know. I had that vision of that morning on that bus, getting back on that bus, and my daughter was starving, and me standing there with that bottle of wine. And I understood for the very first time. It clicked inside here what it meant to me. I don't know what it means to you, but what it meant to me. Is that when I'm an alcoholic, and when I put alcohol in my body, from that point on, it doesn't matter about who I love, about what I love, about my dreams, my plans, sure as hell don't matter about yours. When I put alcohol in my body, it owns me, body and soul, and I have to do whatever it tells me to do. It tells me who I can be with. It tells me where I can live. It tells me when I can eat. It tells me everything. It's just like being in prison. They tell me everything the alcohol did. And if there's not enough money to feed my only child, you know, so be it. I have to have the alcohol first. And I finally understood what the way alcohol affected me. And that they said that no human power was ever going to fix me. I kept hoping one of you gals in AA were going to fix me. You know, a few of you tried. I've always been grateful for it, but it didn't work out for either one of us. I've been to churches. I've been to AA. I've been to NA. I've been to all these things from coast to coast. 1,000 people had reached out and tried to help me. And I had tried to help myself for 6 years. I'd been going to these meetings trying to get sober. I wanted to be sober more than anything in this world. But I kept thinking one of you people were going to do it for me. You were going to say something. You were going to, I was going to get the right sponsor. I was going to get this. Some speaker's going to say something's going to happen, you know. Nothing happened. Says, got to that last part, and the part I hated and scared me from the gate, man, and that was that God stuff. I said, but God could and would if he were sought. I started thinking about the people who had what I wanted, and it had nothing to do with their money, their stuff, or their women. It had to do with the way they walked through this world with a little bit of dignity, with no matter what happened to them. They walked through this life and accepted life on life's terms, and they didn't drink alcohol, and they didn't use narcotics, and they didn't run from any of it. They just walked straight ahead with dignity. And every single one of them had the same thing in common. All of them talked about this power that did for them what they could not do for themselves. I got down on my knees that morning. It was the most sincere moment of my life. And I got down on my knees, and this is what I said. I said, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you are. I don't really think it makes any difference. But from this point on, I will do whatever you put in front of me. If I don't have to drink any alcohol. And if you're not there, I'm fucked. you know. And I meant that from the bottom of my soul. If there wasn't something there that was going to help me right now, I'm a dead man. All I know, the longer I've been sober, what a state of grace was given me that morning. And every single person I know, I heard this young lady tonight talk about it. When I cried out to the God of my understanding or misunderstanding or whatever, with no deals, no conditions, I'm out of angles. I'll do whatever you put in front of me from this point on if I don't have to drink. I've heard that sentence 1,000 times in Alcoholics Anonymous meeting all around the world. I went and got Charlie, and I asked Charlie to teach me how to stay sober one day at a time. And that old man, he got me active. He walked me through the 12 steps in 9 months. He was in action, man. There was no waiting around on this stuff. He got me actively involved in service. He had me in the hospital institutional committee at 30 days sober. And I had to have a commitment at a step study, a men's meeting, and a big book study. And I had to carry five commitments every single week at other meetings. And I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night and actively involved in every single one of them. I had to get to every one of them a little bit early to shake hands with every person that walked in, because I didn't like people. You know. And he made me stay late after every one of them to say goodbye to everybody and help them clean it up, to show gratitude. She says, "Don't you ever hear, let me hear you talk about gratitude in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if you're not actively involved. Otherwise, it's just talk. You know, gratitude is action." And great things came to pass. I met the woman of my dreams. I met a beautiful woman, and I got married. At 3 years sober, the state of California had given me a driver's license back, and I packed the state contractor's board, and I became a contractor. I signed a contract on a big giant skyscraper down here in San Diego. I went down and I bought me a brand new truck that day, paid cash, and I came home and the telephone rang. And this little girl said, "Is your name Kip?" And I said, "Yeah." And she says, "Well, do you know Sandy so-and-so?" And I said, "Yeah, a long time ago." She goes, "That's my mother and you're my father. And I've been looking for you for 23 years. And that little girl came into my life. And she brought me 3 beautiful little grandchildren. You know, at 10 years sober, I had everything. You know, I was teaching baptism at my church. I was a hospital institutional director for North County, and I had been for 8 years. I owned my own business. I had 20 people working for me full time. I was making around between $200,000 and $300,000 a year. I had the house on the hill. I had the boat. I had just spent 2.5 months in Australia, traveling around, a dream I'd always had. And I got back from Australia, and I was sitting here, you know, and I was just going, "Man, how do you get from being a wino, from standing in that wine, hand from my to right here? How did I get in 10 years from there to here?" I was just amazed. Every area of my life was so full. I was with the woman I dreamed. All my children were with me. My son was with me. You know, I had adopted 2 other children by this time. And everything, I never dreamed I could have a life that good. And I'm reading in the paper, you know, and I'm reading about this man who got out of prison and broke into this woman's house and raped her and cut her to pieces right in front of her children. And I got down to, and it was my daughter. A little girl that had looked for me all those years. And I went to the hospital to go see her, and this man had taken a knife and he had cut in her face, her breast, and she had lost her left arm, and she did not look human. And I'll tell you this, that I'm absolutely capable of first degree murder if you heard anything I care about. You know, one of the things my sponsor told me when I came and asked him to teach me how to stay sober, he laid out the guidelines. He says, "Kip," he says, "I've been watching you for a long time. People like you don't get sober. Not even an Alcoholics Anonymous, very few of you. So something inside of you is broken. I don't know what it is." He said, "This is the way it's going to have to be for you for the rest of your life." He says, because no woman, no job, no child, no nothing in this world can ever be more important than you doing the things that you have to do to maintain your sobriety. The day that you put anyone or anything in front of you doing the things you have to do to stay sober, that's the day you're getting ready to take a drink, and you'll never get to get sober again. And whatever it was you thought was important enough to not do your AA stuff, you're going to lose. And that's the only thing that was ringing in my head, you know, was that nothing could be more important, not even my daughter. And, you know, that's an easy thing to say, man. But let me tell you, when the rubber meets the road, it's a hard thing to practice. And the hardest thing I've ever done in my life was get down on my knees on a daily basis and pray for that man who did those atrocious things to my daughter to have everything out of life I want. And if you think that's easy, try it. You see, as I look for an angle in that book, I got that book out and I read it. I'm looking for a hook in here somewhere, you know. And all it says is this. It says that anger and resentment will cut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit and the insanity will return and I'll drink again. Doesn't say unless someone rapes or cuts up your daughter. Doesn't say that anywhere in there. Just says straight out that I cannot live in that mode because it will kill me. And I got through that. I ain't going to tell you I forgive that man. But I'm telling you I learned how to deal with it. And that insanity went away. And I still work on that part. And I was able to be there for my daughter and my grandchildren. I had the resources to help her. For the first time in her life that she really needed me. She needed a father and I was there for her. And you guys gave me that. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. You know, I thought I was going to get... I got to the other side of that and things started going all right. And then they told me I had cancer and they had to cut my lips off. And I like my lips right where they're at. You know? I'm in a lot of emotional pain. They want to do this radical surgery on me and they got to give me dope. You can't give me dope, you know, for any reason. Nothing's more important than me being clean and sober. You can't put anything in my body that affects me from the neck up, especially if I'm in some kind of emotional pain. You know, you can't do that. I can't handle it. And I had to talk a doctor into doing a surgery with Novocaine and aspirin, you know, and they did a plastic surgery and cut this lip from here to here to here, a wedge out, put it back together with plastic surgery with Novocaine and aspirin. And let me tell you, that hurt like hell. And it hurt like hell for a long time. You know, they sure as hell did. Cost enough. It cost enough. I got through the other side of that, you know, and the only thing that was real solid in my life was my marriage and my God and AA. You know, and I loved this woman with all my... First woman I'd ever really been intimate with, that I really told her who I was and shared myself as another man with her, you know. And we were as close as two people can be. I noticed something was going on between us, and I didn't know what it was. And I came home, and I said, "What's up with you, Connie?" And she goes, "We got to talk." And I sat down, and she held my hand. She says, "You know, I don't know how to tell you this, kid." She goes, "You know, you're the man of my dreams. You're the best husband I could ever ask for, you know. And if I wanted a man, you would be the man." She goes, "But I can't live this way. I can't live this lie no more." And I said, "What? What are you talking about?" She said, "I'm a lesbian." You know, and I didn't react that nicely. I didn't know how to handle this. I have no tools for this, you know. Well, I didn't think, I didn't know what she was going to say that, you know, And I reacted the way I always react when I'm scared. You know, I got angry. I got mad. I said some horrible things to this woman I loved. You know? And I went to my sponsor and I'm telling him about how this woman has wronged me. You know? And he starts laughing at me. And he goes, "What do you mean she wronged you?" And I'm saying, "Man, I did this, I did that, I did this, and did this, and then she did this." Because you sound just like that guy on page 61. I said, "What are you talking about?" You know, the guy that thought he could wrest satisfaction out of life if he only managed well. Sometimes he was nice, sometimes he was kind, sometimes he was generous. But everything he ever did had a hook in it, you know. Did you do this for this woman because you loved her or because you were trying to control her, you know? Did you expect to get something back for doing the right thing? And, man, that was like a slap in the face, you know, and, He said, "I want you to go home and write about this. Go write about love. Go write about your marriage. Do an inventory." And I had to go do that. I had to go write about love. The only thing I know about love is what my kids taught me.
Only thing I know about love is what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous taught. You didn't ask me what my sexuality was when I walked in here. You know? I'm sure you really weren't interested. You know? You didn't care about anything except that you loved me because I was an alcoholic. That's what you loved about me. And you always loved me. You always stood by me. My children, after even the way I treated them, they loved me. They loved me unconditionally. You know? And that's the only thing I knew about it. And I had to go write about that marriage, and I realized that that woman was a dynamite wife. She completed her vows. Everything that she said she promised me she would do, she did. You know? And she came honest to me and talked to me face to face about this. And we divorced very amicably, you know, and she kept my last name. And today she's my sister. She's not my wife anymore, and she's a very dear friend of mine. And I didn't know you could do that, you know. I didn't know you could do that. And if some woman does that, you kick into the curb and go next, you know. And of course, I told right after that, I told my sponsor, I'm very lonely. He says, you're not lonely, you're horny, you know. And he says, you can't have no relationship until you don't need one. I said, what do you mean? He said, you can't have a relationship with anyone until you don't need a relationship. When you're comfortable with you and your skin and your life is great, and you don't need anyone in your life, then you can bring someone into it. You know, then you have something to offer someone. Otherwise, you're just looking for someone to fix you. You know, and there ain't no human power that can fix you, kid. You know, and that's what it had to do. You know, right after that, the only thing my little girl, she got married, the one that was born, and he gave to me, and I was able to give her the kind of marriage I dreamed about the day she was married. You know, and a real nice young man came and asked me for her hand in marriage, and I make this payment every month, and I will the rest of my life for that wedding, and I never regret it. And the son of a bitch took my daughter to Texas. You know, I don't like Texas. I really don't like my daughter being there, but he took her, you know, and they're gone. They've been there ever since, and it was just me and my son, you know, just me and my son. 10 years sober, everything else was gone, and my son got sick, and I spent the next 5 months in that hospital with my son. On October 4th, 1993, he died in my arms. And it was at that time that I got to experience the truth of what these promises really mean. Says, well, no serenity will know what the word means. And, you know, and I know what the word means. Serenity to me has nothing to do with watching a beautiful sunset with her with a pocket full of money. You know. Serenity is being able to watch the thing you love the most in your life die. And hurting more than you know it was humanly possible to hurt. And at the same time, knowing in your heart of hearts that this is God's business and God don't make mistakes. You know. I got through all that, and I'd never done anything. I went to school. And to wind this up, my story's long. I'll tell you the way things are today. I was 14 years sober in May. Since my son died, I went to college. I got a degree. I got several certificates. I went into a job at marketing. I'm a marketing director for a company. I met a woman who I'd known for a long time, and we started dating a little bit. And I was crying out to God one day, I realized my life was full. Everything in my life, I don't need to add anyone to my life. I'm comfortable. My skin fits. I liked my little house. Me and my dog, you know, and it's just good, you know. And I got on my knees that morning in my morning prayer. I said, God, if it's your will, I would really like it if you would allow me to experience true love one more time in my life. But I don't need it, you know. It's okay if it's not your will. But if it's your will, I'd like to experience true love one more time in my life. And I'm giving it to you, and I'm not going to say nothing else. 2 weeks later, I got a phone call. I was speaking down in San Diego down here that night, and this lady, this gal I'd been dating, her mother called me up and she said, oh man, Carmen got in a horrible car wreck. She, you know, she started drinking again, and she got brain damage and she's in this hospital. She's probably never going to get out. I went, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Is there anything that I can do to help? She goes, yeah, you can come up here and get your daughter. And I said, my daughter? She goes, yeah, you have a 3-month-old daughter. You didn't know? And I went, no.
I didn't know anything about it because she had moved to L.A. I hadn't seen her in about a year. And I drove up to Los Angeles, and they put this little girl on my arms in a little bassinet, and she looked at me and smiled. And you know what happened? I fell hell over heels in love, man. Just head over heels in love. You know, my good friend Benny. Benny's her favorite. She's Uncle Benny, you know. And she's my Nanu Nanu. That's what I named her now. And people said, well, aren't you going to have a blood test? And I said, no. And they said, well, maybe she's not yours. I go, yes, she is. God gave her to me. I ain't giving her back either. You know? And I had to speak that night, and I drove down here to San Diego, and I walked down, and I didn't know what to do, man. I don't know what I said that night. I just set the bassinet right here. And she looked up at me and smiled, you know, and I just, bro, you know, I had no idea what I said. I'm glad they didn't tape it, you know. But, oh, you did? Oh,
I was there.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Evidence. You know, my life was so full, me and that little girl, you know, and we grew closer. And I was at a meeting one night, a meeting I've been going to since I got sober, and there's a gal there that me and her have been on many committees together for many years, and had the utmost respect. I'm just a little bit sober, just a little bit longer than her. And she asked if she could hold my daughter, and I said, yeah, sure. And so she was holding Nanu, and I'm looking at the way she's looking at her, and I'm looking at the way my daughter's looking at her. And I'm going, wow, there's a match, you know. I said, Sabrina, so how's John? She goes, oh, me and John have been divorced for a year. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I said, well, you don't mind me asking, what's happened? She goes, well, I wanted to have children, and he didn't. And I went, oh, really? You like kids, do you? And we got married. And 11 months ago, she put a little boy in my arms. And his name is William Casey, and we call him God's Will. And my son was born on the day, 25 years after the day my son was hit by the car on the same day. And God gave me back a healthy young man, and he's my baby, he's my boy. And I wouldn't trade my life for anything that's happened to me. I wouldn't trade places with any human being on the face of the earth. You know, my sponsor, I wind this up, my sponsor, I sat with him right up until he died. And I held his hand. He died of cancer. And he said this to me, Kip. He says, Kip, he says, you've come so far. And then he cut me off, you know, he saw my head go a little bit, and he said, but you got a long way to go, you know. And he says, Kip, he says, I'm going to give you a promise that ain't in the big book, and I'm going to give you all this promise too, you new people. He says, you'll stick around and do the things that we ask you to do, if you'll become a part of this, not just attend meetings, become a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, enmesh yourself in this. He says, I'll guarantee you that someday, sometime, and I don't know when, someday you're going to be walking by a mirror and it's going to be about midnight. There ain't going to be no one to impress. It's just going to be you. You're going to see the man looking back that you always dreamed about being. And I ain't here to tell you that I'm any big deal. You know, there's people here that know me, you know. But I'll tell you this from my heart to yours. The result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I am the best man I've ever been in every area of my life. You know, and I owe that to Alcoholics Anonymous. I take no credit for it. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to live in a world that I've never understood. It's taught me how to do things that I don't know how to do. You know, it's given me a life that I would not trade places with anybody in the world. You know, and I offer it to you, along with everyone else. And that's all I got for you. Thanks for letting me be here.